Welcome. Thank you for joining me. Hope everything is going well with you. I'm going to be starting session four in understanding the history of socialism as a restraining influence of moral virtue decreases in a country. The methods of voter fraud increase, losing ballots, voting multiple times, as we've seen, mail-in ballots lost, altered, or added to, delay in counting military ballots, same-day registration fraud, inaccurate ballot preparation, allowing non-citizens to vote, refusal to purge voter rolls and those who died or moved on, orchestrated computer glitches, rigging of electronic voting machines, hacking into state election systems by the Department of Homeland Security, or blame on foreign interference. False polling data published prior to an election prepares voters to accept fraudulent election results. If by chance the voter fraud is discovered, politicians promise to investigate, and in the course of investigation, they have opportunity to destroy any evidence which would convict them. If public pressure mounts, excuses are made that the fraud was an unintentional, unauthorized, or result of ineptness. Ultimately, a low-level scapegoat is blamed, allowing the politicians to stay in office. Another concern is that one party's push for a universal mail-in voting, millions of new ballots could overload the postal system, causing counting of them to drag on for weeks, especially if there are demands for recounts and legal challenges. What happens if the counting is not done by noon on January 20th, when the 20th Amendment requires the president and the vice president to vacate office? According to the interpretations of Presidential Succession Acts of 1792 and the Constitution Article 2, the Speaker of the House would become the acting president. Since potential for corruption lies in human heart, the remedy is to exercise external vigilance. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass wrote in the North Star newspaper, March 1848, "The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. It can only be maintained by a sacred regard for the rights of all men." Andrew Jackson stated in his farewell address on March 4th, 1837, "But you must remember, my fellow citizens, that eternal vigilance by the people is the price of liberty. You must pay the price if you wish to secure the blessing." Socialist Antonio Gramsci wrote in the New Order, "Socialism will triumph by first capturing the culture via infiltration of schools, universities, churches, and the social media by transforming the consciousness of society." Plato explained that in the perfect society, the governing class would not only dictate what is acceptable behavior, but also determine each child's skills and abilities and assign them their work for life. Just like the computer terminology, there's hardware and software. A child's body and brain is hardware, but the ideology they are taught is the software, which gives them their identity and purpose. Just as the Bible, in one aspect, is like a behavioral software program, i.e. love your neighbor as yourself, love your enemies, so atheistic socialism is like software virus. The battle for the future is over who gets to load the software on the next generation's brains. Malware, viruses, and corrupted files loaded on a child's brains produce narcissistic, selfish behavior. Students must abandon their parents' morals and adopt ever-evolving government-dictated beliefs. Yale President Timothy Dwight warned that Voltaire's atheistic agenda included controlling the education of youth, books replete with infidelity, irreligion, immorality, and obscenity. William T. Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education in 1889, drawing from socialist philosophies, Hegel, Kant, Froebel, and others, he said, "Our schools have been scientifically designed to prevent over-education from happening. The average American should be content with their humble role in life. They're not tempted to think about any other role." John Dewey, in the middle works, "Education which trains children to docility and obedience, to careful performance of imposed tasks because they are imposed, regardless of where they lead, is suited to an autocratic society. These are the traits needed in a state where there is one head to plan and care for the lives and institutions of the people. Marx stated, the education of all children from the moment they can get along without their mother's care shall be in the state's institutions at state expense. Antonio Gramsci wrote, before puberty, the child's personality has not yet formed, and it's easier to guide its life and make it acquire specific habits of order, discipline, and work. Lenin stated, give me 4 years to teach the children, and the seed I have sown will never be uprooted. Stalin stated, education is a weapon whose effect depends on who holds it and in whose hands it is aimed, and at whom it is aimed. Communist Party education workers, Congress stated in 1918, we must create out of the younger generation a generation of communists. We must turn children who can be shaped like wax into real good communists. We must remove children from the crude influence of their families. We must take them over and speak frankly, nationalize them. From the first days of their lives, they will be under healthy influence of communist children's nurseries and schools. They will grow to be real communists. Hitler stated in November 6, 1933, when your opponent declares, I will not come over to your side, I calmly say, your child belongs to us already. What are you? You'll pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time, they will know nothing else but this new community. Hitler stated of the National Socialist Workers' Party, this Reich stands and is building itself up for the future upon its youth. And this new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing. Representative Albert Herlong Jr. read into the U.S. Congressional Record in January 10th, 1963, a list of communist goals, which included discredit the family as an institution, emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents, control schools, use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda, soften curriculum, get control of teachers' associations, put party in line in textbooks, gain control of student newspapers, belittle all forms of American culture, and discourage teaching American history. J. Edgar Hoover wrote in 1954, the American home ceased to be a school of moral and spiritual education. When spiritual guidance is at the low ebb, moral principles are in a state of deterioration. Secularization advances when men forget God. In Paris, John Adams wrote, in vain are schools, academies, and universities instituted if loose principles and licentious habits are impressed upon children in their earliest years. The vices and examples of the parents cannot be concealed from children. How is it possible that children can have any just sense of sacred obligations of morality or religion if from their earliest infancy their fathers are in as constant infidelity to their mothers? Dr. James Dobson addressed the National Religious Broadcasters in February of 2002. He said, if they can get control of the children, they can change the whole culture in one generation. There is a concerted effort to manipulate the minds of kids. A stem cell is a cell in the human being that in the very early stages of development, it is undifferentiated from others. In other words, it is not yet other kinds of tissue, but it can go in any direction depending on its environment. Do you understand that children are stem cells for our culture? Progressive utopians are criminals. They are genocidal psychopaths who have killed more human beings in the last 100 years than any other ideologies in history. They don't limit their murder just to individual, but to entire nations. As the National Socialist Germany's war against anti-communists, Cambodia's slaughter of the educated middle class, the communist Chinese cultural war, and all of this was done in the name of creating a new utopian society. In the United States, the socialist utopians adopted a new and unique method of conquering a nation by dumbing down its people, by destroying the brain power of millions of its citizens. The plan to dumb down America was launched in 1898 by socialist John Dewey, outlined in an essay titled The Primary Education Fetish. In it, he showed his fellow progressives how to transform America into a collectivist utopia by taking over the public schools and destroying the literacy of millions of Americans. This plan has been so successfully implemented that it is now a fact that half of American adult population are functionally illiterate. They can't read their nation's constitution or the Declaration of Independence. In fact, many of them can't read their high school diplomas. The method of achieving this was simply by changing the way children learn to read. The utopians got rid of the traditional intensive phonics method that forces children to read English as if it were Chinese. The method is widely used in today's public schools. It's called the look-say method. They look at a picture, they learn to see a word associated with that picture instead of using phonics and being able to learn hundreds of thousands of words. They're limited to a few thousand words that they can learn through this method. It was used to help people that were absolutely deaf and they couldn't use phonics to pronounce words. That's where this education method was. But it was tried in Boston and failed after 6 months. But Dewey thought, well, this is a good method because he wanted it to fail. In 1898, Dewey warned his colleagues about being too hasty in carrying out the plan. He wrote, change must come gradually. To force it unduly would to be compromise his final success by favoring a violent reaction. In other words, deception would have to be used in order for his long-range complex plan to be successfully implemented. Educators learned quickly how to deceive trusting parents and taxpayers, how to manipulate politicians. They also knew that children would be powerless to resist their abuse. Teachers have been taught to blame academic failure on the children, not themselves. Indeed, many of them revel in the idea that they are transforming America to suit their own social fantasies. John Adams stated, the Native American who cannot read is as rare as the appearance of a comet or an earthquake. Yet federal literacy in 1993 stated that 55% of Americans were functionally illiterate. And that's after huge amounts of money had been spent. The dumbing down of a nation was and is for the purpose of overthrowing the government. It involves deliberately harming the minds of the child, pornographic sex education, even in kindergarten, promoting atheism, nihilism, evolutionism, which for many, many times results in addiction, suicide, homicide. Horace Mann, a socialist and humanist, went to Prussia and brought back the whole word method, which was used for deaf people because they couldn't hear the sound of phonics uses. This was a total failure after 6 months in Boston produced dyslexia, a permanent reading disability, brain damage in healthy children. Rudolf Fetisch found that teaching of reading all over the United States in all schools, in all the textbooks, is totally wrong and flies in the face of all logic and common sense. Do you know that there is no remedial reading courses in Austrian schools, in German schools, in France, in Italy, in Norway, in Spain, or any other place in the world except in the United States? Did you know that there's no such thing as remedial reading in the United States until we switched to this present reading method around 1925? When progressives took over American education at the beginning of the 1900s, their goal was to use schools as a means of changing America from a capitalist, individualist, believing nation into a socialist, collectivist, atheistic, humanistic nation. A November 1987 article in The Reading Teacher described the socialist purpose behind whole language. Whole language views the learner as profoundly social. Thus, practice congruent with whole language includes participating in a community of readers during a small group literature study, peer writing workshops, group social studies projects with built-in plans for collaborative learning. The purpose of whole language is to get rid of individualism. Reading is not a whole language item. It's not a whole language item. It's not a social or collectivist activity. Reading is an individual activity in which the reader is engaged with the author in a one-on-one basis. Indeed, reading is one activity in which an individual can retreat into his own world of thought and pleasure by absorbing the words and experiences of authors of living and dead. In January 1889, the Phi Delta Kappan by whole language guru Frank Smith makes it quite clear that whole language is a political movement, literacy and power. Literacy can do more than transform, though it can transform the world. Literacy can raise social consciousness and provide a means for the expression and fulfillment of consciousness. When children gain mastery over the alphabetical system, they acquire tremendous intellectual power. But that's not what the utopians want. Dewey's socialism was so extreme that he even denied an individual ownership of his own mind. Charlotte Iserby, who passed away recently, was in the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan. She got there by some fluke. She didn't have the qualifications, but she was brilliant, and she saw what was going on in the Department of Education. It was really a communist institution. If you could control the Department of Education, you could control what the people, the students, would learn. And so by 12th grade, American children are math and science dunces by international standards. We just need to see the government schools not as they claim to be, but as they, not as they claim to be, or as they once were, but as they are now, irreformable. A survey published in 2001 by the Colonel Williamsburg Foundation found that a quarter of teenagers had no idea that the American states fought each other in the Civil War, or that 13 original colonies declared independence from England, and 10% couldn't identify the first president of the United States. One third didn't know who Abraham Lincoln was, did not know that the Mississippi flowed down to the Gulf of Mexico, or whom the U.S. fought in World War II. The curricula, the institution, rules, staff, and many teachers in public schools are hostile to Christianity. Teachers and administrators are frequently dismissed or disciplined when they express their Christian faith. Even if public schools accommodated Christian symbols and rituals, they would still be unfit for the Christian children, because legal necessity commits the schools to a non-Christian worldview. Behind a constructivist approach to history, the evolutionary approach to biology, the Marxist view of economics, the multiculturalism, tolerance, values clarification, integrated math, and outcome-based education is an atheistic worldview. Marketing terms are masks to cover the true agenda. The education and development of young people is and should be a major concern of parents as well as religious and political leaders in America, but around 85% of Christian parents are still sending their children to these humanistic indoctrination centers we call public schools. Worldviews are not inherited, they are learned. Many students absorb the secular worldview from the classroom simply because the parents don't reinforce a biblical worldview at home. Many historians, philosophers, and scientists claim objectivity in a chosen field, and many Americans adopt the idea that basic education skills and facts can be taught without a religious or philosophical basis. Dabney explained the impossibility of neutrality in education. The instructor has to teach history, cosmogony, study of origins, psychology, ethics, the laws of nations. How can he do it without saying anything favorably or unfavorably about the beliefs of evangelical Christians, Catholics, deists, pantheists, materialists, fetish workers, or all who claim civil rights under the American institutions? His teaching will be indeed the play of Hamlet without the part of Hamlet. Howard Zinn, wrote A People's History of the United States, and it sold more than 2.5 million copies. It is pushed by Hollywood celebrities, defended by university professors who know better, and assigned in high school and college classrooms to reach students and teach them that American history is nothing more than a litany of oppression, slavery, and exploitation. This is wrong. In debunking Howard Zinn, Mary Grieber shows how Columbus was not a genocidal maniac and was in fact a defender of the Indians. Why the American Indians were not feminist, communist, sexual revolutionaries ahead of their times, how the United States was founded to protect liberty, not white males' ill-gotten wealth, why Americans of the greatest generation were not equivalent Nazi war criminals, how the Viet Cong were not well-meaning community leaders advocating for local self-rule, why the Black Panthers were not civil rights leaders. Zinn used dishonest rhetorical tricks such as reliance on partisan history, explicit rejection of historical balance, selective quoting of sources to make them say the exact opposite of what the authors intended. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Arthur Schlesinger wrote in an op-ed titled Folly's Antidote in New York Times, January 1st, 2007, "History is to the nation as memory is to the individual." As persons deprived of memory become disoriented and lost, not knowing where they've been, where they are going, so a nation denied a concept of their past will be disabled in dealing with its present or its future. The longer you look back, said Winston Churchill, the further you can look forward. I believe consciousness of history is a moral necessity for a nation. John F. Kennedy wrote an introduction to the American Heritage, New Illustrated History of the United States. History, after all, is the memory of a nation. Just as the memory enables an individual to learn, to choose goals, to stick to them, to avoid making the same mistake twice, in short, to grow, so history is the means by which a nation establishes its sense of identity and purpose. If history is a nation's memory, then America has national Alzheimer's. Pulitzer Prize-winning Carl Sandburg wrote, "When a nation goes down or a society perishes, one condition may always be found: they forgot where they came from." Harvard professor George Santana wrote in Reason and Common Sense, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." Lord Acton wrote in 1877, "The story of the future is written in the past." Patrick Henry stated in 1775, "I know of no way of judging the future but by the past." Will and Ariel Durant wrote in The Story of Civilization, 1967, "History is the excellent teacher with few pupils." The Durants wrote in Lessons in History, "Civilization is not inherited. It has to be learned and earned by each generation anew. If the transmission should be interrupted, civilization would die and we should be savages again." Reagan warned in Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, 1961, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in our bloodstream. The only way it can inherit freedom is we know it is the freedom we have known is if we fight to protect it, to defend it, to hand it to them with the well-thought lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was like to live in America when men were free." Terry Mortensen, writing in his book, Searching for Adam, said, "How did we get to the place where the evangelical churches are losing 70% of their young people when they graduate from high school? Why is America on the verge of national suicide? Why is Western Europe, once so powerfully impacted by the gospel and missionary-sending continent, now the most difficult mission field in the world? Why don't 60% of British teens believe in the existence of God? Why do less than 2% of Britons go to church regularly? This assault on gospel was led by the takeover of the American public schools by humanists led by John Dewey. Their main beliefs are first that the universe is self-existing. Past history of our globe must be explained by what can be seen and happening now. So no powers are to be employed that are not natural to the globe. No action to be admitted except those that we know in principle. This rules out, of course, supernatural creation and a supernaturally induced global flood at the time of Noah." And based on Hutton, Charles Lyell wrote Principles of Geology, in which he tried to free science of geology. Hutton basically made a statement that this rule of what we see today is what has happened in the past. And they called it uniformitarianism. So that's what we have today. Wayne Grudem, in his Introduction of Systematic Theology, writes, "What's at stake? A lot. The truthfulness of the three foundational chapters of the entire Bible. Belief in the unity of the human race. Belief in the ontological uniqueness of human beings along with God's creatures, belief in the special creation of Adam and Eve in the image of God, belief in the salvation through representation by Christ, belief in the goodness of God's original creation, belief in suffering and death today are a result of sin and not part of God's original creation, a belief in the natural disasters today are the result of fall, not a part of God's original creation. Belief in the evolution erodes the foundations. Evolution is a secular culture's grand explanation, the overriding meta-narrative that sinners accept with joy because it allows them to explain life without the existence of God. With no accountability to any creator, no moral restraints to restrain their sin, no fear of God before their eyes, Romans 3:18. And now theistic evolutionists tell us that Christians can just render to this massive attack on Christian faith safety inoffensively tack on God, not as an omnipotent God who in his infinite wisdom created all living things, but as an invisible deity who makes absolutely no detectable difference in the nature of living beings as they exist today. In 1978, atheist Richard Bosworth declared boldly in American Atheist magazine, "Christianity is, must be totally committed to the special creation as described in Genesis, and Christianity must fight with its full might, fair or foul, against the theory of evolution." It becomes clear now that the whole justification of Jesus's life and death is predicated on the existence of Adam and the forbidden fruit that he and Eve ate. Without original sin, who needs to be redeemed? Without Adam's fall into a life of constant sin, terminated by death, what purpose is there to Christianity? Thomas Huxley, in 1893, said, "I am fairly at a loss to comprehend how anyone for a moment can doubt that Christian theology must stand or fall with the historical trustworthiness of the Jewish scriptures. Bios Logos' promotion of theistic evolution leads to heresy and views of the crucifixion of Jesus as sinful and thus in opposition to the will of God. Theistic evolution poses a significant challenge to the substitutionary atonement. Bios Logos has received $8.7 million from the John Templeton Foundation to promote theistic evolution in the church through the web, through speakers at conferences, in churches, and by developing resources for pastors. Theistic evolution believes that God created the earth the same age that the evolutionist, the atheist evolutionist, uses, 13.6 billion years ago. The universe was created. The earth was created about 4.6 billion years ago. And through progressive succession, the theistic evolutionist or progressive creationist believes that pretty much the same timeline as the atheistic evolution, only they say there's a God behind the process. Problem is, when you give them billions of years, all of a sudden, that's the magic wand to say that evolution occurred, because now they have enough time, they think, to cause evolution to occur. They don't, but they use that as an explanation. The John Templeton Foundation gives money to seminaries, including Trinity Divinity School and several others, to fund this progressive creationist mentality. Bruce Waltke, one of the greatest Hebrew scholars of all time, reported that 46% of evangelical professors do not have any real objections to theistic evolution, which is horrible if that's true. Most Christians and Christian theologians, he says, today are two-thirds to three-thirds evolutionists, according to Terry Mortensen. And Charles Spurgeon advocated the gap theory. Charles Hodge favored the gap theory until about 1860, when he switched over to the day-age theory, which is the progressive creationist view. But 2 Peter 3 says, "Knowing this first, that there shall come days in the last days, scoffers, walking after their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since when did the fathers sleep? All things continue. From the beginning, uniformitarianism. For this they are willing and ignorant of, for that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world then was, being overflowed with water, perished." That's catastrophism. That's what the Bible teaches. But geologist James Hutton argued that geologic processes occurring today have occurred since the foundation of the earth. The idea, again, as I said, is uniformitarianism. The same processes you see today are the same processes that existed for time eternity. He came up with this before he'd even bothered to look at a rock. And based upon this, uniformitarianism spread throughout our scientific community. Because of the foundational importance of Genesis, it is not surprising that the forces of unbelief have attacked the book, which shows us who God is, who we are, what our problem is, and God's solution to that problem. As humanistic theories of the Enlightenment gained control of Europe in the 1650s, building on Darwin skepticism concerning the plain teaching of Genesis on Earth's age, and is able to bring about the abandonment of the traditional interpretation of Genesis in favor of a full-fledged evolutionary paradigm and non-theistic worldview. The reign of evolution long-age theory is a major factor in turning Western culture from Christianity to naturalistic humanism. Because Christian institutions of learning nearly always accommodated the Bible to scientific claims rather than to such claims to the Bible, Christianity has lost its message and its authority in the minds of most of the world's population. And with that, I close this session. Thank you for listening. I could see it. That really wasn't my end for this session, but I'll start where I'm left off.